Hello and welcome to the Selfish Podcast. Today we have Kyle Yates, who I actually met through being a guest on his podcast. I'm excited to get him on the Selfish Podcast. He is the owner, the creator, and the host of his own show and the Vibes Broadcast Network. So go check it out online after you've listened to this first. So welcome, Kyle. How are you today? Hello. And can you share with myself and the audience, where in the world are you?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on. And second of all, I'm doing about as good as I can do. That's the best answer I can give you today. And I am just outside of the wonderful capital of the best state in the United States. I am just outside of Austin, Texas. So, and I tell people that I am a narcissist. I have to live in the same town that's named after me. So yes, I live in the city of Kyle.
Oh, nice. So it's like your own city there. I've always wanted to see the States. I've yet to see it, but Texas is definitely up there on the list of the places I want to see, you know, a country within itself. And yeah, just so much to see and to be, but it's beautiful to be able to connect with you over such a large space. And in a time, like, I think it's important that we use technology rather than it use us. And I love that you're creating what you create in the show that I was on with yours, where you're just sharing, again, conversations and experiences and inspiration. And from the conversation we had in your story, the reason I wanted to get you on is because I really found your story motivational and inspirational, and I wanted to share that with my audience. But before we get to there, I'd like to go a little bit further back with my audience to their younger life. So can you paint me a picture of what life was like, say, pre 10 years old? It's frozen down on my end.
That was the best. I mean, I had the best grandparents anybody could ever ask for. My home life. I mean, my mom loved me. Don't get me wrong. I questioned whether my dad really did. He molested me when I was younger. So that was very, very hard. And I suppressed it because I thought maybe it was my fault and I didn't want to relive it. I was embarrassed too. I didn't want anybody else to know. So it took me till after I was, gosh, my late 30s, early 40s before I ever even told anybody.
Yeah. That was what I was going to ask you. At what point did you get to the stage where you're able to share that? Because I know certain things like that, we, one, lock the door on them and try and bury them. Sometimes we even repress them and we forget until something triggers it. But it's often to publicly speak about it takes a lot of courage. And it takes a lot of self-growth, I would say, to be in a position where you feel like that isn't your identity anymore. So you can share it. That was my personal experience with certain traumas. It's like, that isn't what defines me. You know, I'm going to use that experience, but like I tell you a little bit about mine, I think we might have covered it, but my mom was really ill and she suffered severe mental illness. And I couldn't even say the words, my mom is ill, without just breaking down. So I hid it. You know, many people never knew. Some people probably only found out once I started talking online about it, you know, and it's like, but yeah, I thought I would hide it forever. So I congratulate you on your development and your courage and yeah, for being able even to say the words shows a great development within your life.
Well, I've only recently started sharing it with more people because there's so many folks like me that have gone through the same thing and they do keep it to themselves. It eats them up inside. Sometimes it'll even take hope away from you. You know, it'll take away all your self-confidence. And if you see someone who is out in public and shares their problems, sometimes that will motivate other people to either one, seek help, be able to talk about it, or find that there is hope out there. So that's I'm not looking for sympathy by any means, but what I am doing is trying to tell others, hey, look, there's people like me that went through the same thing.
Yeah, and apologies if you can hear barking. There's someone walking their dog and you might have seen a dog running around there. And no, definitely, I think there's such a power in sharing something. And that's why I created the podcast, just to share experience. Like, there's no real criteria on guests because everyone's had a life and experience. And although our experiences can be all intertwined, different and unique, the feelings and sensations that we experience through them are actually quite similar a lot of the time, you know? So we all go through that guilt, that shame. Like you said, that you thought maybe it's your fault. Like, there's so many people that have had something that's happened to them that clearly isn't their fault, but it's happened to them. And we go through that cycle and we go through that sort of pattern. And I'd be interested to know, like, when you was younger, like teenage years, because it would have been extra hard, but was it, what was your, I don't want to use the word escape, but what was something that you did that gave you some form of balance that you just enjoyed?
Well, my thing was, I started drinking when I was 12. And alcohol was very easy for me to get, even though my parents didn't drink. My dad had epilepsy, so he never drank, but my neighbors did. And so it was cool to go over and watch a baseball game and drink beer and, you know, a lot of rum. And it became a habit. And I started smoking marijuana when I was between 12 and 13 years old. And then that developed into a lot of other things. It'd be quicker for me to tell you the things I didn't try than the stuff that I did. And, you know, just getting messed up all the time. I even would get high before class. I'd get drunk and high before class. And that's how I made it through my day. And I, like I said, never shared that anything with any of my friends or my family about what happened to me. I just blocked it all away. And drugs became an escape. It made life easier to tolerate. I was a weird kid already, and I got picked on a lot. And let's just say I didn't want to be here. So I thought maybe that would be my way out too.
Yeah, no, I think when we suffer, like, I had suicidal sort of thoughts and feelings from a really young age, from like about 7, I think I started to question it. And it was just that pain of suffering, not feeling, not only that you don't fit in, but there's just no excitement left. There's no joy left. And it's just, you feel like just so hopeless is the only word, really. Like, they just feel there's no point, no hope. There's no future. There's like, do you know, and you feel that trapped. And again, that is why I think it's important to share that story, because you never know who's listening and they might be in that place at the moment. And then they hear one person even talking about it and just going, well, that is how I felt. And they can resemble that, feel that. They go, but they don't sound like they feel like that now, and they're still here. Do you know? So I think it is, there's such a power in sharing and connecting and communicating. So that was your, say, teenage life and stuff. But when you was younger, do you remember your first ever, if you had one, do you remember your first ever ambition? Like, something you wanted to do, be, or become? Like, did you have a dream or desire? Like, one day I want to do this.
I always wanted to be an artist. I had this dream that I was going to be an album artist, you know, because I love music. I love the artwork that came on a record album. And I said, yeah, well, that's what I'm going to do one day. Of course, I thought records were going to be around forever. So that goes to show how old I am. But, you know, I wanted to so bad. But once again, that lack of self-confidence, I think, really kept me from chasing my dreams. And then I latched on to the first woman that I thought I could spend the rest of my life with. And so I got married at a very young age. I was right out of high school, literally 19 years old. And that's, you get married and you think you're still going to chase your dreams, but you find that you've get that first 9-to-5 to pay the bills, and you're kind of stuck in it. You don't have the chance to go back to school, especially when you're having babies when you're real young. You know, I have 3 children. My daughter just turned 30. So, and I'm only 52. I'll be 52 this coming Wednesday. So,
yes,
happy birthday to me.
Happy birthday. Yeah, no, I do think that's, especially when art, like every art's just to me, it's just an expression, but it has so many mediums, so many different directions it can go. But when you have just high, say, creative ambitions, it's very hard to confine that to say, oh, I'm going to be creative between the hours of 6 and 7 and I'll be working 9 to 5. It's like it doesn't fit boxes. There's moments when you feel super creative. There's moments where you don't. There's plenty of things that make you feel uncreative. Like you said, when you get into that structure and that system of working like that, you can often lose that. And that was for me an issue because I always had all these dreams and desires and passions. And I was like, I need this. But if I just felt, if I went down that route, if I went 9 to 5, if I done this, I wouldn't do it. So I was like, I will struggle and go through things. But I also met someone when I was really young, when I was 15. And I was like, I'll be with this person forever. And I thought, but she's got to put up with me not just following my dreams, you know? And always saying, I'm going to make it and going to do something with it. But then the depression and all my childhood traumas, which I hid, were bubbling inside and causing me to be depressive, you know, have just a bad mood and be miserable and then become very militant on myself and therefore like cold, you know? So I think, and that's our relationship. We got married, but it never worked. We were together for 10 years. And sort of fortunately, we didn't have children. So it wasn't that, never that pressure and that obligation never come. But that was because I was like, if I have them, I will have to go get this job, I will have to conform to this sort of style just because I wouldn't not be able to provide. I would not be able to give them that shelter and everything they need. But now, yes, I can really resonate with that and that being your path then. But now your children are older. Are you doing anything towards art now in your life?
Well, art has actually become difficult for me. As I told you on my show, I've developed a disease in my spine. And it has damaged my nerves quite a bit. So even just to write is difficult. But my wife says what makes the art beautiful is the mistakes that you make. And I'm like, okay, whatever. But I don't know. I've kind of lost the desire and I'm more focused on doing what I'm doing right now. I'll do a little bit of art here and there, and it's either little projects around the house or for my grandkids, you know, but nice. I'm not like pursuing a career in it. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. I was actually talking to someone the other week, not on a podcast, just someone I know, and he's like an artist, but he was trying this year, his main goal and ambition was to make money off his art. And as he started going down that route and like getting into digital art and stuff, and he was an older guy, he was about 60, and he had to learn different things for technology, and he's getting inspired and he's getting things, but then he was getting stressed, and then he started to go, I'm finding it hard to paint. And he goes, and it was like getting to his core, and just literally a couple of days ago he's like, do you know what, I'm never going to make money from art because I don't want to. He goes, it's ruining that feeling for me, it's ruining my actual what I enjoy and what I love. And he's like, I can make money in a different direction because I've got other trades and things that I've done all my life. And he goes, for something in me, I think he's just been encouraged to sell his art and sort of just spark that inspiration, you know. Mm-hmm. But he had to go through the realization, it's like, actually no, I'm doing this for me. I mean, they say this isn't for sale.
That's the problem, is somebody has something that they do real well, and then they decide, you know what, I'm going to make money at it. And maybe in the beginning, it's great, it's wonderful. But then when you're pressured into, oh, I have to get this done and I have to get it done at a certain date and time. And when you're pressured into doing what you love, then you stop loving it as much. I mean, some people may not feel that way, but I've seen it. I've seen people that even with their music, they get out there and then you've got an album company telling you, hey, or a record label company telling you, hey, I need you to get this music out at this time and it has to have this sound to it. Then they're just like, I don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah, like they started as a freedom of expression, then it becomes expression with rules and boundaries, and there's the freedom was what was so fun. And once that's gone, it seems to be, it's like, it's just no point anymore. You see it with, what was I watching the other day? It wasn't music. It was something else. I think it was a book writing. Someone was talking about being an author. And they were saying like, they really enjoyed creating their first book and getting all their words out and telling a story about them, their life and development. They said, and they even got it published by a publisher and they wanted it. And he goes, as soon as they had done that deal, the publisher contacts them and says, so when's your second book? and they're like, oh, I haven't got a second book. And they're like, oh no, you need to have a second book. And they said they didn't even have to drive for a second book, and they didn't want to do one, but they felt like obligated now. And they're like, oh, well, I should do, you know. And you know, if you should all over yourself, you know, it's not going to be as good.
Yeah. When you're forced into creating that, there's a blockage there. For me, I have to be motivated to do it. Sometimes I can look at something and say, oh, wow, I'd like to do something similar to that. Or I love the way the sky looks, or just the scenery, and you want to recreate it. And then you're motivated to go do it. But when somebody says, hey, I want you to go do a painting of this, this, and this, I really don't want to do that. I want to do what I want to do, you know?
Yeah.
That's why I hated when people would ask me to do specific drawings, like, oh, can you do my family portrait or something? I'm going, God, do you realize how much work that is? No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah. So how did podcasting enter your world? Now, I was shocked when we spoke on your show that you're on like over 500 episodes. Yeah, this is 10 times more than where I am right now. This, you're going to be number 59 of my episodes going out in a year. So I'm interested, when did you start? What inspired you to start? And yeah, just where did that inspiration come from and your drive to do so many?
Well, if you remember, I told you I'm a paranormal investigator, and that was my dream. What I wanted to do, and I did it. I even started my own team after a couple of years, and it's wonderful, but there's just not enough for me. So I told my wife, I got to do something else paranormal wise. And we thought of, hey, let's do a paranormal podcast. So gosh, I realize now it's been almost 6 years since I did my first podcast, and it was great. I loved it. And I was contacting all these people that I saw on television, and I'd contact other paranormal teams and just anybody that was involved in the paranormal. I was trying to get them on, and this lady messaged me, and she said, well, I love your show. Would you be interested in joining our network? And I thought, wow, this is a great opportunity. Well, this is where I come back to, if you're doing it for somebody else, it's not as fun. Yeah, I had to be on every Tuesday, 7 p.m. Central, and then have a guest that would be willing to be on live that time every week, because it was a live show. I just couldn't keep doing it. It was not sustainable for me. And so I told her, thank you for the opportunity. I think I just want to go back to doing my own thing. And so once again, I'm doing my own thing. Well, I was working part-time as a security guard, and we were working a Comic-Con, and I meet Adrian Paul. Now, for those that don't know who Adrian Paul is, if you ever watched The Highlander back in the 90s, he was the Highlander on television. He also was in several of the movies. He was the cousin of Christopher Lambert, you know, the original Highlander. And he's played the bad guy, like on shows like Arrow. I don't know if you're familiar with Arrow or not, but he's done a lot of stuff. Okay. And he's a sword master. So I stop and I talk to him when I'm on my break. And we spent probably 20, 30 minutes talking about arthritis and how to take care of it. So that's how you know you're getting old. Once again, I have arthritis that runs through my body as well as the disease that I have. And I thought, wow, how do you not ask somebody like Adrian Paul to be on your show? So I asked him, would you be willing to do a podcast? And he goes, sure, here's my information. And I tried very hard to figure out how I was going to get him to do a paranormal podcast. So that struck an idea of, I need to do something more, because here's somebody that has just inspired me, and I think he can inspire other people. We need to do a show that inspires and motivates people just talking to whether it be your entrepreneurs or authors or, you know, just your regular Joe that on the street that has just gone through so much and, you know, wants to share their story. Or, you know, I've had so many great people on the show, and that's what spawned doing this particular show. So listen to the vibes. And I do my paranormal show, but I just don't do it as often. I just really, really love helping people. So, and that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Oh, nice. Well, it's really nice how that ended up sort of manifesting, coming together, and really interesting. And like you said, I think this, that sharing and connecting people's life stories, and I think it's like a, it's an element of just support and encouragement. I was actually talking to someone on a different podcast, and I was saying, like, a lot of people have family and friends, but I said, they'll support you when you're breaking down. Maybe if you're lucky, you've got family and friends, they'll give you a bit of support, but they don't often know how to rebuild, say, the problem. But they don't also know how to encourage, because it's been foreign for so many people. I think real encouragement, because we shut away a lot of our passions, dreams, or just maybe we don't know. But I think, like, a lot of them stories I find from listening to my guests give me encouragement to keep going, or to just do what you're doing, or to just live life, or to look at things a bit more openly rather than support me. You know, it's like, oh, they're not supporting me, they're encouraging me in life. And I think that's missing for a lot of people. So now, again, congratulations on the adding that to your show and offering that to people.
Now, I'll have to say this. Most of my inspiration and motivation has come more from strangers than my own family and friends. Now, I'm not saying this is the case for everyone. If you have somebody in your family or in your circle of friends that help you, awesome. Hold on to them. I have family and friends that love me, but when I started breaking down, I got the old, oh, I'm so sorry. And, you know, if you need anything, let me know. And then when you want to talk, you just want to talk. Oh, I'm kind of busy, or, you know, there's always some kind of excuse. That happens to too many people. I have talked to so many people that it just, it breaks my heart how many people that don't have that support of family and friends like they think they do. And some of these people are even famous people. So if you've got them, hold on to them. But some of the help comes from strangers. Yeah. Your audience doesn't know me. Most of my audience, they don't know me. But I put my email that on the description of every one of my videos so they can contact me. Say, hey, man, I'm going through a rough time. And if I can't help you, I will get you to somebody who can. Or if you just want to talk, I'll be here to talk to. So I'm going to leave it there.
Yeah, nice. It reminds me of, I had a guest who, her, I think it was like her great granddad. She was an older lady herself. So the advice is going back at least 100 years, maybe 150 years. And he said, there's no such thing as a stranger. He goes, it's just a friend I haven't met. And I was like, oh, I really like that. You know, yeah. And it's that sort of mentality that, because we're taught stranger danger when I was younger. You know, and it's like, no, some of the kindest people, you just haven't met them yet, but they're just another person, you know. And again, for me, when Danielle, I don't know if I told you in your show, but Danielle had she had a cardiac arrest, and she dropped dead, and then she came back. But at that time, I had always had friends, but because I'd closed myself off because of my past, they didn't really know me in that intimate level, I would say. And then when stuff all hit the fan and I needed people around me, I was like alone, looking after someone sort of dying in my arms. And I was like, I don't have any friends. I have acquaintances, you know, and I didn't have, like, maybe one would turn up now for a little bit to help me with something, but it was really minor. I never asked, but it's like, if you were what I thought before, like from what you get from movies and TVs, if you've got this friend system, these close friends, they know when you're needed. They know when you need them. Sorry, you don't have to ask. So I was under that sort of assumption that, like, when something goes really wrong, they're all going to come in. They're all going to help out. You know, whether that's even like cook you some food and bring it in because you just haven't had time to even make yourself something to eat that day. And then again, I've seen it in TV, you know, they're bringing the lasagna dishes around and everyone's bringing food and, oh, the fridge is too full because you've had such a hard time. Everyone's being there for you. And I was like, that never happened. And it was a harsh reality to sort of face.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, there's a bit of a catch 22 when I get a message and it says, do you have time to talk? Part of me is happy and excited that this person has reached out and wants to talk to me. But then there's also in the back of my mind, oh my God, I hope everything's okay. You know, I'm glad that I'm here for them to talk to, but I also don't want anything bad to happen to them, you know? So there's that. But if somebody messages or calls me and says, hey man, I need to talk. I want to be there for them. I feel very guilty because, you know, my little brother ended his life and he was only 22. Mm. And when he called me one night, I'd been working and I was just really, really tired. And he called me in the middle of the night. I had to get up early and go to work. And I'm like, can I call you after work? But he needed me at that moment. And because I wasn't there, he's not here. You know?
Yeah. So how old would you be then? How little? You said he was 22?
He was 22. So I was about 29, almost 30 years old. And,
yeah, you never know how much the littlest act can make a big difference. I think that's just a good sort of, for me, I see that when I hear stories like that. Thank you for sharing. It's like, okay, like try and be the best version of you at all times to be supportive for people. Do you know, even if it's subtle gestures, when you see people, that you smile at them, that you show them an act of kindness, because you don't know what they're going through. They could be a stranger, but that one little interaction may change their behavior if they're having a really bad day, time, life. You know, so it's like little gestures.
So ladies, if a man walks by and he smiles at you or he says, you know, hey,
can you hear me? It froze for a second.
Oh, did you get any of that?
All I heard, I don't know whether Zoom got it. It seems to be a Zoom issue that happens fairly often, but I heard, ladies, if a man smiles at you, and then it froze.
Well, I was trying to say that, you know, there's guys that will walk by and it will smile at a woman or even say, hey, you know, why don't you smile? They're being genuine. They're not being perverts. I'm not saying that not all of them are, but you know, I'm just saying it's not for you to judge. Just if somebody's smiling at you, accept that smile.
Yeah, you know? Definitely. And you know, I always loved when I see things in America. Now, I don't know if it's the same where you hear over where you are, but England's known as being polite. Yeah. And that's not my memory. And I've been all over England. I don't, no offense to English people out there, it's where I'm from, but I never found it to be the most polite place in the world. And when I see American TV and I see like whether it's a reality show, everyone's like really polite. They're all saying good day. They're all saying hello. They all seem to have a friendliness, like a friendly nature that I never had growing up or saw. And then when I came out here to Spain, it's like, it's amazing how friendly some people are that you can walk along and they will say good day to you in Spanish. Like they will say hello to you when you just walk, especially in the villages. Like in the village, they'll walk into a shop and the person will say hello to every person in the shop. Like they walk in and say hello really loud so everyone hears them, or everyone says good day to each other. And it was so bizarre for me at first because that's not where I came from. That's not, you look away or you ignore people like they're invisible. You know, you look at your feet. It's like, if you're looking at someone, you must have bad intentions or something. It's like, you couldn't look. But when I was here, I was like, oh man, it's so, like, it was uncomfortable at first. It took time. But now I'm like, I love to say, I see an old person walking along to me. I can't wait to be the first one to say good day to them and smile at them. You know, if I beat them to it, because they'll say it to me.
It's funny because, you know, growing up here in Texas, you know, well, for my generation anyway, we were taught to be polite. You said hello to everybody you met. If somebody needed help, then you reached out, you know, especially where I lived at, hurricanes would come through and you'd have all these tree limbs and trees knocked over and, you know, just all this damage. So I remember the neighbors helping each other, you know, cutting up all this wood and hauling it off trash and, you know, fixing roofs together. And we just helped each other. And, you know, you always had a, how you doing? Or, you know, you at least nodded your head when you were walking by somebody. You acknowledged the person you're walking up next to. And I've just been used to that, you know, always, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. That's just the way we were raised, to be polite. Took a trip to New York a few years ago. Totally opposite. I mean, you ignored everybody, or at least they ignored you. And the only people that talked to you were the people looking to get money out of you. That's it. It just blew my mind. You didn't get the, how you doing? You know, of course, here in Texas, we all say howdy. It's not a cliche. We do. We say howdy. I don't know, man. It blows my mind how one part of the country is totally opposite from the other part of the country. I just think we should say hello. I'll spend extra time in line at the grocery store, not get in the line with the automatic grocery, you do it yourself. No, I'll go to the line where there's a person doing it for you, just so I can say, hey, and, you know, do my dad jokes, you know?
But yeah, no, it is so strange. Like I said, back where I was from in Cooley, it was just south of London. So right outside the big city, and then near an airport city. So it was very city life, but yeah, very cold. And I went out into the countryside. I've been around quite a lot of England. And so some people be like, oh, no, if you go into the countryside, it's real nice. But I was a bit younger, a bit more rougher looking, you know, and I think maybe that they didn't want me there. You know, they could tell that I'm from a city visiting their country village and I weren't getting happy looks, you know, and I weren't doing nothing wrong. But yeah, they didn't look like they wanted me there. So I wasn't getting in. You're just getting this face watching you everywhere you go. It was no hello, howdy, good day, none of that. So yeah, I have no memories of anyone being polite in that sense, but I love it over here. And that's what I want to see in America as well. It's like, go to Texas, go to see someone say howdy as you walk down the street. It's just, well, to me, it's just friendly. Like you said, it's just common. It's not harassment. You know, it's not aggressive. It's the opposite. It's like, it's showing that, hey, I recognize you. You're here in this time, in this moment with me. And we just passed each other. Why not have a nice greeting? Why not share a little bit of a positive energy or emotional sort of connection that's just pleasant rather than cold?
Well, my grandmother, she just passed away this last year. And she was in her mid-90s. And I can still remember as a teenager, I'd bring my friends home or over to her house. And I would think, oh, my God, my grandparents are going to see my friends with the, you know, my long hair and, you know, earrings and all that stuff. And she's going to freak out. But my grandma didn't treat anybody any different that came in the house. It didn't matter who you were. I mean, she grew up in a time of poverty and prejudice and things like that. And yet she didn't show any prejudice towards anybody. If you came in her house, you were welcome. And oh, nice. You were going to be treated like family. So be prepared. She was going to feed you and everything else.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I think a lot of people, like talking to someone else the other day and talking about their parent growing up in a different generation, but I think so many older generations, like you said, weren't full of this prejudice. Like they just had a warmness to them. They didn't have this coldness because they just were in a totally different time without all these obstacles and pressure. Know that for the most part, I think most people many years ago were very pleasant people. And there's always going to be some rotten apples to say, but I don't think the majority were.
Look, my parents, they grew up in a time where they were fighting prejudice. Okay. It was deep, very deep. And when we came up and my parents were saying, you know, hey, don't be prejudiced against other people. Well, then things started to change for the good. We were seeing that change. And I don't understand why we're going backwards. It's I mean, I don't want to get all controversial on your show, but I mean, the truth is we had gotten so far and things were really working out good for people that were bringing up stuff that most people today haven't gone through. I mean, let's face it, they haven't. Maybe there are a few. I'm sorry if that's happened to you, but for a majority, they haven't. And yet we're going backwards. We're labeling each other. We're separating each other. I never thought I'd see the day when here in the United States, they want to have separate, graduations for white people, black people, Hispanic people, you know, Samoan people, everybody separate. Why? We fought to do this together. Why are we separating each other? That's going backwards.
Yeah, because there's there's a certain amount of unity that you can continuously see, say, growing. And then suddenly you've seen like it's suddenly, like you said, going the other way, like a dive, like it's like a bad stock chart. It's like, oh, this has been going up and down for a while, but it's constantly getting better. And then suddenly there's just a dip. And it seems like that. But I can't see the majority of people, unless I'm just fortunate to come across lots of nice people. Do you know, like from my experience, I don't see that attitude in people that have this diversity. Some people are agitated by it and it causes them to act angry, but they don't like have all that issue within them. It's just some people seem to still do, but then they're aggravated and pushed into that place.
Well, these kids nowadays, they've been so privileged. Everything's handed to them. And it's my generation's fault. I mean, we had all these children that we made sure they had cell phones and stereos and TVs in their rooms. I mean, it was a big deal when I got a TV in my room, and that's only because my parents was throwing the TV away.
Yeah.
And they didn't go through the hardships. And so everything's given to them. They're so privileged nowadays that they're trying to find stuff to get upset about, you know? I don't know, every generation has to have their, you know, whatever they're fighting the powers for, and they don't really have that. So they're making stuff up.
Yeah, I think that's a big part. And I think it's also what they were given gives them an insight and connection to information that even my generation wasn't connected to. You know, so you're given all this information at a point when you're like a sponge. So depending on what you're consuming in that time is what's going to aggravate you and push you. Like I was talking to a guy who's a similar age to me, and we grew up, both had mums who were single, who suffered mental illness. And we talked about like the difference of, I didn't have an online community to connect with. There was no internet. You know, there was like a drawer and a pen and paper in my room or something, you know, but there was no one to talk to, nothing to do. I can't imagine the benefits and the sort of curses that exist, like the duality of some of the benefits that someone out there that could be suffering can tune in, you know, and connect to someone when they need it. And at the same time, the amount of, let's call it rubbish, they could also be consuming that's going to be sending them in the wrong direction. I think that's a big part of, like you said, they haven't had to earn something, and then they get bombarded with stuff. It's going to drive them a little crazy.
Something else that I've seen is, yes, the internet is a good tool to have if you use it properly. As I've said in my show before, you can have a hammer and you can build a house, or you can have a hammer and you can do destruction. The internet is a great place for people to get together that have problems, legitimate problems. And I think you have a generation of kids that see this and they start to feel kind of jealous because now these people are getting attention. And so they start making up problems. And because I see some of the most ridiculous stuff on the internet, I'm thinking, what in the world were you thinking? The problems that they come up with are ridiculous. And I'm not trying to poo-poo everything that happens on the internet, because there are people who genuinely, they have problems and they're looking for help. But some of this has just gotten way too far out of hand. I mean, like you said, there's stuff that happened in my parents' generation that I'll never understand. Same as when their parents. I mean, my grandparents went through the Great Depression, World War II, and all these other things. They went through real hardship. My parents, you know, they saw the Korean War and Vietnam and, you know, all the race wars and everything that was going on. And, you know, my generation, we saw the Cold War and all these problems with nuclear weapons. I mean, when I was born, was just as the Vietnam War was starting to end. And, you know, one thing we all held in common was what we worked hard for, what we wanted. If I wanted something really bad, I worked for it. I mean, I still remember working all summer to buy me a stereo and, you know, all these other things that I really, really wanted to have. And I think when my generation started having kids, we kind of felt bad that we didn't want them to have to work as hard, and mm-hmm. we've created this monster. So it's our fault. It is our fault. You know, I still made my kids do chores, but I gave them a lot more money than what I got when I did chores. You know, yeah. And I didn't make them do that much. They'll tell you opposite, but I hardly made them do anything. And I think they thought I was bribing them. You know, hey, go wash the dishes. I don't want to do it. Okay, I'll give you $10. Okay, I'll go do the dishes. You know, that kind of thing. We've created this, and what are we going to do to fix it? That's what I'm saying. Were we supposed to be going in this direction?
Yeah. In any direction, like this conversation. But no, I think that's a great question, though, isn't it? That's the main question. What are we going to do to fix it? And that is a genuine conversation to be had. And that's, I'd say, my goal is always trying to grow that idea, to try and really get the, like anything, you can't have the answer because it can always change, because everything's in motion, everything's always changing. But if you have zero answer, then you're not fixing anything. You're probably contributing to a problem. So for me, my answer would be, how much can I connect with people, share a love for life, share compassion, use my experiences, use my stories, so that they feel just better about their life and any trouble they're in, so they're more productive, while trying to help people find a purpose in life to serve. For me, life's about service. You know, so you're here to serve in some form, not for yourself, and you live to give. So it's like, where's your area of service? Everyone's unique. Everyone should serve somewhere. If you're being self-serving and you just take, things just fall apart. But I feel innately that we find joy in service. That's like our place. It's like, I say it like we're the caretakers of the earth, the animal kingdom, and humanity. And some people fit perfectly in each one, but they need to find that and reconnect with it. So for me, it's like, try and work towards that in all moments. And that be my, say, dream and passion, is to try and work just towards making that for people. And it's like, that's the only way I can see to fix it from my own experience, because I'm not in a position of, say, power in any way to change literal rules or laws, but I am in power of myself and my influence.
Well, I think what is happening, and I'm sorry to the dismay of some people that may be watching or listening to this, but there's a younger generation that's coming up that's becoming more conservative. And the reason why I think that is because my generation is starting to feel that regret of not spending as much time with their kids as they should have, and now are spending more time with the grandkids. And the grandkids are growing up more conservative than their parents were, or this other generation that's coming up. And whether that's true or not, I mean, I'm just speculating here, but it's funny that I'm hearing more and more stories of these kids are like my grandkids' age that are starting to see the value in hard work. And what am I say? They're seeing things like I saw them. They're starting to listen to the same music that I grew up listening to, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty freaking awesome, you know. Now, this is not true for everyone. This is not a blanket for everyone by any means, but I'm just saying that I'm hearing more stories like this. I'll have that conversation with some of the musicians that I have come on my show, and they're like, yeah, it's kind of crazy. These little kids that are 10 years old are starting to listen to our music. <I'm> like, what?
Yeah.
Maybe there's hope.
Yeah, because they're plugged into one thing so they can get stuff. But like I said, it's really interesting what you're saying, like, because their parents are having to work all the time, that the grandparents get so much time with them. And the grandparents have learned what they've done wrong with their own kids. And they're like, I'm not doing that to the grandchild.
Exactly. You know? Exactly. I mean, I feel bad because I didn't spend as much time with my kids. And it wasn't that I was working all the time. It's like when I wasn't working, then I was getting drunk.
Hmm.
Yeah, it was all about me. I'm tired. I don't want to talk to anybody. Just leave me alone. Let me watch my football game, you know? And I feel so bad that I did that to my kids. And I tell people my kids are successful in spite of their father. And it's sad to have to say that, but the work ethic that my daughter has to go as far as she has in her life, and how she raises her kids even stricter than what I did, you know, my boys, they have gone out and pursued what they wanted to do in life. And why didn't I do that? I just took whatever job I could get, you know, whether it was construction or I was I was an exterminator. I worked for the city. I mean, I spent most of my life doing public works in the water department. And I was garbage man at one time. I mean, I did all these jobs just to make money. And that's where I went wrong, was just making money. I'm glad my kids decided to do what they wanted to do in life.
Yeah, and we're coming up to near to an hour, so I don't want to take all of your time today, but I'm curious, like, if you don't mind, like, so your relationship with your kids now, and you're clearly not drunk now, how long have you been sober for? And have you got a relationship back with your children?
I've been sober now for I've been with my wife now for 8 years. So I'm going on about 15 years of sobriety. And even though my relationship with my daughter is a lot better than what it used to be, I can still tell there's some resentment there. And I don't know if she means it or not, but I don't blame her. But my boys, they've been very forgiven. And in fact, my youngest one says, Dad, quit bringing up all the stuff you did in the past. You don't do it anymore. Like, you're right. I don't do that anymore, but I still feel guilty. I still beat myself up to this day. And it's, you know, forgiving yourself is the hardest thing that you could ever do. I could have somebody just totally screw me over and I could forgive them and not even think about it ever again. But I cannot forgive myself, even when others have forgiven me. Isn't that weird how that works?
Yeah, I think it's a very hard thing. Like you said, you feel like to blame, but also, like, I know my dad went through issues that he wasn't able to, and I can feel it in him even to this day, that he still is uncomfortable that he wasn't able to be there for me and my brother when my mom was really ill. She still got custody in England just because she was a female, but she was diagnosed with extreme mental illness at the same time. And she wasn't capable of looking after children, yet she still had them, you know? So we went a lot of times without food, no carpets, really bizarre behavior and all sorts going on. And then we hid it from my dad as best as possible. But when, like, we told him things later in life, I could see how much it was hurting him. Like, he was blaming himself. You know, he was suffering something that happened 20 years ago that he wasn't able to be there to fix it, to do something about it. And I think it just shows strong father characteristics in him, and same in you, that it's like you realize now that that's already within you, you know? So it's like, that's powerful. And at the same time, my mom wasn't able to be a mother, and she was my biggest trauma in life, but she's my biggest gift in life. I wouldn't be who I am now. I wouldn't be here trying to help others or be of service or realize even that, I don't think, if it wasn't for her shaking up my life so much. You know, it's like, so I think what your daughter, the achievement she has, your son and achievement, they may not have been anywhere near who they are now that you're so proud of, if you hadn't been an alcoholic. You know, they would have had a totally different life story. They might have been the kids that you can't stand right now. Be like a spoiled little, you know, they might have gone a different way.
And thank God that they're not alcoholics, you know. Oh yeah. My God.
I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
Yeah, there's a story you might have heard of like a psychiatrist story, and it was like this guy was interviewing twin brothers, and they grew up from a dad who was an extreme alcoholic. He said really abusive and an alcoholic, and one had become sort of a man of faith, didn't touch alcohol, the other had become drunk and abusive. And he asked them individually, he said, why do you do what you do? And they both answered exactly the same. You know my father, you know why I do what I do. But they're both taking it in totally different directions, to the extremes as well, totally opposites. Do you know? So I think that's our choice. And it sounds like your kids have done the other, they've seen what they don't want. You know, they probably don't drink around their kids. If they have a little drink, they're probably cautious about it. They're like, I don't want to be drunk. But the fact that you've transformed and come through it, that's obviously going to give them the possibility of change. I think it's, again, inspirational. So I don't think you should feel so bad about it. That, you know, I know that's hard and easy to say.
Yeah. And if I can leave with some parting words, the things that have become a part of our lives, whether it's like me, I've had this disease and all the things that I've done wrong in my life, they are a part of you, but they don't have to define who you are. You decide that. Decide what you want to be, who you want to be. Be the best of whatever it is that you want to be.
Yeah, nice. Thank you so much. I do have, before we go, just some quick little questions. They're like one answer questions I ask every guest at the end of the show. Do you have a couple minutes for them?
Sure.
Yeah, so if you had to choose one, a cat or a dog?
Oh, my cats.
Cats. How many cats you got?
Got four. I'm the cat man.
The cat man. I've got a few myself, so okay. Two cat men here. But I do have one dog. But there's more. The cats out. They outnumber the dog.
I mean, I want a dog, but I have my cats, and my cats are my emotional support animals. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And what's your favorite color?
Black. If you can't tell.
Yeah. What sound or noise do you love?
I can't say that on air. No. The sound of music.
And what sound or noise do you not love so much?
My ex-wife.
That might be my favorite answer so far. Tickled. That got me, that did. Maybe throwing off my next question. What do you love about yourself?
My kids and my grandkids.
What do you love to see in others?
I love to see that inner strength when it seems like hope is all gone.
Nice. And last question, what do you love about animals? This can be your cats, this can be pets, or just animals in general in nature, however you want to perceive.
The thing I love about animals is that even when, you know, you might be rude to your animal, but they're always going to love you no matter what. And like for me, I told you, my cat is an emotional rescue. Emotional support. That's what I was trying to think of. She's an emotional support animal. And when I am feeling like my anxiety or my PTSD kick up, she gets in my lap automatically. She knows it, and she rubs all over me and that kind of thing. And I pet her and she helps calm me down. So they do so much for us, even when we don't do so much for them. Because how many of us have a pet? Most of the time we ignore them.
Yeah, and I think that's so common for people, but I love that that's what you're saying. And I have to send you the episode when it comes up, but it's my love, Danielle. It's her mission, her passion is animal welfare, but she also wants to create, she wants to rescue animals. And I'm putting this in a very short little box, but she wants to rescue animals and then use them in a way that people get to experience that feeling, that sensation that you're experiencing, that have been through neglect from human abuse. So, because I think there's a connection, there's a bridge there, because that's what happened to her. You know, and she can connect and get that love from an animal when the trust for humans was gone because they've been so abusive. You know, and the animal has a power over bridging that gap, I think, and bringing someone back into a place. Like you said, it brings you back into some sort of harmony. So I think animals have an incredible power to for us, but we mustn't neglect that value in them. They're extremely valuable, worthy beings.
I heard that. I have to change one of my answers.
Yep.
Because the greatest sound in the world is hearing my grandkids say pawpaw.
Ah, nice.
That is absolutely the most satisfying sound in the world.
I look forward to that sound one day.
It'll happen.
One day. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Carl, for being on. It was really great to get to know you more and hear your story, and I look forward to sharing it with my audience.
Thank you.
Truly appreciate you for coming on.
Anytime, brother.
I truly appreciate you for listening to the very end. So if you did, hit the like button, subscribe for more content just like this, and check out patreon.com/LukeGreenheart on how you can support this broadcast, this mission, and my content creation. I am creating compassionate content to share, to love, and to shine. So come check it out.